Advisory Board Meeting, March 18th, 2021, Part 2.
Consent, that would be the responsible party. We always check with going in person. We are back in regularly now. We have resident advocates who are individuals who volunteer for our program and go into nursing homes to work from 4 to 6 hours a week, working with residents on complaint resolution, helping them develop a resident council, sometimes working with family councils, and supporting them to have the highest quality of care. We also do education and outreach regarding right to long-term care communities, trying to educate staff and make sure that they're fully informed as to what the expectations are related to residents' rights. Residents' rights are protected at a federal and state level through the Older Americans Act. During this period of time of COVID, there were some parts of the residents' rights that were paused and waived under a federal waiver, and then at the state level, part of that was related to visitation and access. So traditionally, residents have the right to access any person at any time of their choosing. In order to ban a visitor, there has to be a court order, otherwise the nursing home, residential care home, or assisted living can support visitation. They can do a supervised visit, find other way, for those that happen in a safe manner, as long as the resident wants to visit. And visiting hours are a suggestion. I know many long-term care communities post visiting hours, so they're suggested hours. Residents can have anyone visit at any time. The only thing we ask is that if they have a roommate and they would like to visit and they're going to be talking and it's late at night, that maybe they go to a lounge or a private area where they can conduct that visit and not interfere with their roommate's sleep. We have 8 regional ombudsmen throughout the state. Myself as the state ombudsman. And then I have 2 intake coordinators who answer the calls, chases in, and triage things. And I have an administrative assistant that works to also answer calls but facilitate things with me. We are administratively housed at the Department of Aging and Disability Services. And that's important because I have autonomy. Autonomy when it comes to what bills I support, how I advocate, and the things that I see as essential to be moved forward and to bring residents and family members' voices to. For many state agencies that have to go through the governor's office and they need permission to be able to do that. And in my role, I don't need that. I do believe in being transparent and making sure that people are fully informed, and I think it's important that I let my commissioner and governor's office know, especially if there's something that I'm going to be backing that maybe they don't have, I don't have the same level of support from them on or having a difference of opinion. At the federal level, I work to also work on policy, talk about what's happening here on in Connecticut, and to see policy change at a federal level. I'm the co-chair of the Coalition for Elder Justice here in Connecticut, as well as the Right Size Rebalancing Steering Committee. I think that's it. Thank you. That's Ronald. Can you give us your name and contact information, please?
Absolutely.
Well, my name is Maraid Painter, and it's M-A-I-R-E-A-T, and the last name is Painter, like painting a wall, P-A-I-N-T-E-R. And our main number is
424-5200.
we're the long-term care investment program, but we're part of the Department of Aging and Disability Services.
Okay, yeah, because there's a guy here in Norwalk. He's in a nursing home, and I think he's the only totally blind person there. He feels like his rights are being violated. So I'm going to pass this on around to him.
That would be great. And the representative from our office down there, her name is Sylvia Crespo. So when you call her main number,
please put her last name.
C-R-E-S-P-O.
Okay.
When you call the main number,
right,
make sure that you leave the individual's name, a phone number to contact them, and the name of the nursing home that they're in, because our staff work regionally, an intake coordinator will call them, get all of their demographics, and then give it to the regional ombudsman.
Okay, yeah, I'm gonna have the resident call herself.
Good. And because of confidentiality, we then would not update you or give any information back to you unless the resident gave us specific information or permission to do that, just so that you
know. That's totally fine. He's just been trying to find out some information. I've been trying to help him, that's all.
Sure, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Long-term care, all of those.
post a summary of this presentation, especially with the telephone numbers and other means of reaching the long-term care ombudsman with the minutes of this meeting. That way it will be available to everybody who has access to the website, and to also make it available by whatever other means people access their information.
Yeah, I'm happy to take the summary page from Moraine and Margie, and then we can make it an accessible document to attach.
Thanks, Brian. Any other questions from Moraine? Hearing none, I'd like to thank you for this most important presentation, Moraine. I think the information is excellent, and obviously it's necessary, and we appreciate your coming forward to talk with us.
Absolutely. Thank you for inviting me today. I hope you have a great day and stay well.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Our next item on the agenda, then, is the budget update. Brian, you have...
No, we still have Margie on the phone.
Oh, I'm sorry. We still have Margie to present. I apologize.
Okay, ready for me?
You have the floor.
Okay, yes. Thank you. And I think Maureen may have jumped off, but I did want to acknowledge the amazing work that Maureen and her staff have done during the pandemic. They played such a critical role in making sure residents of facilities and their families were informed and connected during such a difficult time, especially in nursing homes. So I did want to share that. So thank you so much for inviting me here today, and I'm here to give an overview of the state unit on aging under the Aging and Disability Services. So with the state unit on aging, we know that most people want to live at home for as long as possible and avoid going into a nursing home, and we have programs that help people stay at home longer by providing services in the home. So the State Unit on Aging administers and manages about a dozen programs, and it includes home-delivered meals, congregate meals, caregiver support, health and wellness promotion, senior employment, health insurance counseling, Alzheimer's respite care, elder abuse prevention. We cover a lot of things. And I'll highlight a few of those programs in a minute. So, overall, the State Unit on Aging is charged with providing administration, programs, and services under the Federal Older Americans Act. And we receive the Federal Older Americans Act funding, along with some state funding, to provide these services as directed under the Act. And the State Unit on Aging is required under the Act to have a state plan on aging, and our state plan is our roadmap for aging services for the future. So we just completed our new 3-year state plan on aging. It begins this coming October. It just began October 1st of this year. It addresses 3 goals: long-term services and support, healthy aging, and elder rights. So to give you a little bit of an idea of how the services get to the community, there are 5 area agencies on aging in our state who receive the bulk of our funds, and that's per the direction of the Older Americans Act. So we pass funds through to the area agencies on aging to provide the programming and services. And the area agencies on aging, also called AAAs, provide some services directly, but they pass most of their funds to local community providers to provide services. They have a competitive process and get the services out into the community. So our role as the State Unit on Aging and at the AAA is mostly the coordinating of these programs and services. It's also important to note that our larger department, Aging and Disability Services, is one of many state agencies that provide services to older adults here in Connecticut. So we're not the only ones. There's many others. For example, Department of Social Services is one. Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services is another. So I think a lot of people come to us thinking we provide everything, like Medicaid and things like that. And we don't, but we connect people to hopefully the best resource for them. So I thought it would be helpful to highlight a few of our programs. Our elderly nutrition program is our biggest program. It provides nutritionally balanced meals, reduces hunger and food insecurity, and promotes socialization for older adults. And the program provides both home-delivered meals, and a lot of people know them as Meals on Wheels, and also congregate meals at sites like senior centers. And we provide about 2 million meals a year to about 21,000 senior center, or some of them just shifted people to home delivered meals if they still needed a meal while we're still waiting for a lot of the centers to open up. Another program we have, which you may be familiar with, is our Choices program. It helps older adults and persons with disabilities with Medicare understand their Medicare coverage and their health care options, and it offers enrollment assistance too. So with its network of professionals and volunteers, the program counseled more than 27,000 Medicare beneficiaries last year. Our busiest time of the year, as you may guess, is Medicare open enrollment season in the fall, and that's when people are making a choice about their Part D plans and their supplemental or managed care plans. So that's another popular program that we have. We also have two programs that are specifically designed to support caregivers, our statewide respite care program and our national family caregiver support program. And where you have family or informal caregivers, who are those who are helping their loved ones, they're helping an older parent, a spouse, a friend, a neighbor, so they can stay home longer. And both programs have a respite component. Respite is a brief break in caregiving. So our caregiver support program is designed to offer caregivers a variety of services. So when they're caring for their loved ones at home, they may be able to use the respite service, for example. And the statewide respite care program focuses on families with a loved one with Alzheimer's disease. And it offers relief to often stressed caregivers by providing some support and services in the home, which is respite. I do want to distinguish this from the Connecticut Healthcare Program that the Department of Social Services has. That's a much more comprehensive, longer-term program than what I'm talking about, which is respite, very much a short-term program, just to help in the very short term. And for, just so you know, for these programs, people don't always have to know where they fit. They don't have to call and say, I want this particular program. I mean, they may do that if they know what it is, but if it's a caregiver calling and they know that they need some services and they contact the Area Agency on Aging in their area, they'll do a screening and an assessment to try to figure out what services and what program would best fit them. So we're not trying to have everybody memorize what all our programs are. It's just if you need help, there are numbers to call for that, which I can go over at the end. So we also have a small employment program called the Senior Community Service Employment Program, and it serves low-income older adults, actually 55 years and older, and it assists them in reentering the workforce. And participants are placed in temporary subsidized training assignments where they receive valuable on-the-job work experience and training needed to gain meaningful employment. And about 100 low-income older workers were helped last year. So I just wanted to spend a minute just talking about what's changed because of the pandemic. Because I feel like talking about the Speaking In on Aging during a presentation, you know, during the pandemic, you really need to acknowledge that things have shifted, and COVID-19 has certainly tested our aging network infrastructure. So many services continued during the pandemic, although they were provided differently. Providers in the community have adapted and reimagined services to provide support to keep older adults safe and healthy. The State Unit on Aging received both Families First and CARES Act federal funding to provide meals during the pandemic, more meals, and also other types of Older Americans Act services that were needed during this time as well. And what we found beyond the meals, which I talked about how we had to shift with the meals because the sites were closed, yet we continued home-delivered meals. We did also find out there were food access issues, so we set up some temporary grocery projects to help with that. And then there was concern about social isolation. And while social isolation was not a new issue when we went into the pandemic, it certainly put a spotlight on it because it became an even more serious concern. So our staff developed a project using some CARES Act funding called Stay Connected. So it addresses social isolation in part through technology, and it screens those at high risk for social isolation and connects them with a Connecticut Tech Act partner from Aging and Disability Services to determine if a device like a tablet or a smartphone would be helpful. And then they provide the training on the device, and through the grant, they'd arrange for the purchase of the device. Some people can purchase their own device, some people need a funding source for that. So with that tablet or some sort of device, programming that their senior center may have and stay active and engaged while they're at home. So, certainly technology, you know, as you may have discussed too, will continue to be important post-pandemic as well. It looked like that was one silver lining that came from this situation. Our progress made with technology will take us into the future post-COVID. And then I just wanted to mention a couple of groups that we're part of, because we're part of a larger movement in the state to really focus on aging. Marade mentioned the Coalition for Elder Justice in Connecticut, and the State Unit on Aging has a staff attorney who is the co-chair with Marade. So we're very much in partnership to work together to prevent elder abuse and protect rights of vulnerable elders. And I am part of the new Age Well Collaborative, which includes various aging network partners and has a vision of an age-friendly Connecticut as a great place to grow up and grow old. And our group is analyzing aging in Connecticut and efforts that move us toward an age-friendly Connecticut. We also have a staff person who's part of the fairly new Connecticut Healthy Living Collective, which is dedicated to healthy aging in communities. And a key initiative is a website that they have that helps you look for different programs that might be good for you if you're looking for healthy living. And then finally, we're part of the Reframing Aging campaign nationally. One of our staff has been trained and does some trainings around rethinking what we know and say about aging. It really tries to address ageism in society. So those are some of the broader initiatives that we're part of, just to give you an idea that it goes, you know, beyond just the services that we provide. So I'm not sure if there are questions at this point or if you wanted me to share some phone numbers or if you'd like me to just share it through Brian in the summary. How would you like to proceed?
Do we have any questions for Margie? By the way, thank you for an excellent presentation, very thoroughgoing, and I think a lot of us have gotten a lot more information than we knew was available through your unit. So with that, any questions for Margie?
Yes, Steve, I have two questions. I'm not sure if you deal with this with another agency, but are you helping them with the vaccines for home people who are homebound and can't get out? Are you coordinating that with other state agencies?
That's a great question. Thank you. Actually, I participate on the homebound vaccine group with the Department of Public Health. And when I send the one-page summaries, it would be helpful. I can give you the link to the intake form. There is an intake form that has gone live. It's not totally public yet, but it has gone live so that people can fill out a form if they feel that they cannot get out to get the vaccine. There's an online form, and if they can't fill it out themselves, the Area Agencies on Aging or, you know, many different agencies will be able to assist with it. It's just very simple with your name and all of that. But again, not everyone can fill out the form themselves. So it's an online form that once it's completed and submitted, it gets routed to the Department of Public Health, and then the Department of Public Health sends it to each town, and each town has local public health points of contact who are prepared to receive the names and then contact people and confirm that, in fact, they are homebound and need a vaccine in their home. Sometimes it's a home health agency that will come out. Sometimes it will be the public health agency. It's being set up right now. A lot of towns already provide this, but some towns are just setting it up as we speak, and it will be ready over the next few weeks if it isn't already. So it will take some time. It will take some time to get a call back. It will take time to get an appointment, as it does for, you know, those who are not homebound. But that's an excellent question. It's something that people have been working on for a long time. It's obviously very labor-intensive to make sure that you can get out to everybody's home and keep the vaccine intact where it needs to be at a certain temperature. That has been the challenge, and the groups have figured it out, and will be, some of the towns, again, have already been doing it, and the rest of the towns will be setting up a process to do that to make sure nobody is missed and that people who are not able to get out of their homes can still get a vaccine. So would it be helpful if I send the link in that one pager?
Sure. That would be helpful. And my
you on that. And when you talk about legal services, we do fund some of the legal services agencies that have a hotline who do respond to these concerns. But I know you want to back up a little bit and make sure that these things don't happen. So let me see what I can find for resources to direct you to the right place for that. Certainly if something were to happen, you know, legal services is one area to go, and they will direct you. But I think it's more about understanding ahead of time what are the guidelines. So I understand your question. It's not something that we oversee or coordinate, but I can see what I can find for resources.
Yeah, well, I just recently, I do Chris Radio Show, and I'd like to have you on the other radio, my show on April 17th, so if Brian can give you my phone number, that would be great. We can hook up a half-hour program with you two young ladies.
Sure.
But I just recently interviewed a lawyer who specializes with elderly law, and he said, he advised very strongly that if there is a legal issue, don't hire your lawyer, call Consumer Protection and let them do it, and it won't cost you. Well, that's a recommendation I'll pass on.
Yes, thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, thanks for that valuable piece of information, Steve. Any other questions for Hargy? Similar to Murray's presentation, Brian, I'd like to ask you if you could attach to the minutes an information sheet and summary of Murray's presentation today, and to make it available also in accessible format to anybody who needs it.
Yes, I actually already got Murray. That's how quickly she sent it in. I'm sure I'll get Margie, and then we'll put them with it. And Steve, what I'll do is I'll send an email to you, Maureen, and Marty to connect the three of you together in terms of the Chris Radio Show.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Thanks for doing that, Steve. That's an excellent public service. I appreciate you doing that. And I appreciate you coming to speak with us today, Margie. Again, similar to Marie's presentation, I think we've gotten some very good information today, and perhaps we've learned some things that we didn't know before. So I thank you for that.
Great.
Any other questions? Hearing none. Again, I thank you, Margie, and look forward to hearing your interview with Steve on Chris Radio.
Great. Thank you so much. I appreciate your time. Take care.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Our next item on the agenda, then, is the budget update. Brian, you have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the governor's two-year budget for fiscal 22 and 23 is out, and I'm not sure folks have had an opportunity to review it yet. It is a very favorable budget to aging and disability services in general, particularly given the economic times that we're in. One of the highlights of it was the proposed transfer of $300,000 of monies that have been going relatively unused out of the Employment Opportunities Fund. That's for long-term support dollars. The recommendation to transfer that to the Voc Rehab program between SV Voc Rehab and BRS to help us address our maintenance of effort requirements. So we were pleased to see that. In past years, that was something our commissioner had to request directly by going to the legislature to request the transfer, so we were pleased to see that. Also, in the Children's Services Program, there is a proposal for a slight increase, but going up nonetheless. We're pleased to see that as well. There was a question at the last meeting in regards to deaf blind services, and I had mentioned it. You know, this was a particularly challenging program to find the services to expend monies on, so there actually is a recommendation for a reduction of approximately about $25,000, but it would still leave roughly about $240,000 available. And just to give you a kind of a snapshot of where those services are right now, as we are in continue to be a bit challenging to expend. So I am not anticipating that reduction will have any impact on the availability of services, particularly when we look at that right now, for instance, Oak Hill is not bringing folks into the community, so we've not seen billings from them. On the Voc Rehab side, I also am seeing that we're having continued challenges in spending our state allotments and our federal allotments, again, because so many of the providers are providing very limited in-person services. Most things are being done virtually still, and virtual services obviously don't have the same cost as in-person services. So on the federal side, as an example, out of an allotment from fiscal 21, which is federal fiscal 21, we didn't get those reallotment dollars, so we had about $4.5 million available, and we still have a significant amount of that funding left, and we have not yet touched into the federal fiscal 21 allotment that we got. So, again, the impact of COVID on the expenditures of services remains very much present. In business enterprises, we still have some fiscal year 20 dollars remaining from the revolving fund, about $250,000 there, and then in the 21 revolving fund, there's still about $1 million in there. Most of the vending facility locations remain closed. We are anticipating the seasonal locations opening up, and there will be some expenditure there, but mostly we're still very much in a world where, because government buildings are not very occupied at present, they don't have enough people going to the buildings to sustain a cafeteria or a food service establishment other than the micro marts, and even those are somewhat marginal. One thing that I will say is that the last stimulus bill that passed, not the most recent one, did include funding to help the vending facility operators around the country whose businesses have been impacted because of COVID. There is some relief funding there, and Connecticut will give in the ballpark of about $315,000, and that money is earmarked to help offset losses that the entrepreneurs experience as a result of COVID. So the statewide committee of blind vendors will be, in fact, convening a meeting now that we've received some guidance from Rehab Services Administration so that they can advise us about how we should divide those monies up amongst the operators that have been impacted so heavily by COVID. So that's the budget update. If there's any questions.
Okay.
legislative update. Andrew, are you available to take the floor?
He may be muted, and Andrew, you might be muted. Connects up with the word dog. I mean, that's the definition in federal law.
the Office of Workforce, they're meeting with the Access Board. Office of Workforce,
might have an interest in seeing get modified, and that came true.
wanted to mention was in guide dogs, it's my understanding that the airlines have one regulations about service animals. And then I think it's section 8, there's another definition. So it's like, you know, three definitions, and it gets confusing at times as to how people are interpreting this stuff.
The most confusing thing, as far as I can tell, is that the Federal Aeronautics Administration, the FAA, has different, and what I think can safely be called looser guidelines. And so that's why you get, of course, those, they're good human interest stories. The person who brought their companion pig on the plane, that's just good news. So the FAA, so if you brought a certain animal that would be allowed on the plane, it wouldn't necessarily be allowed in any of the stores in the airport, because the McDonald's or the clothing store at the airport are not under FAA rules. The plane is. So you might bring a companion animal of some sort, and you wouldn't be able to go into, perhaps, any of the establishments in the airport, but you can get on the plane because the FAA, and I don't know the history behind this, maybe because they were responding to a number of people who freak out getting on a plane more than anything else in their life, and really felt the need to have a support animal. But it has led to some, you know, sort of comical situations, not to put down those people, but there is that a bit of a tension there where, of course, some people who use guide animals in the traditional sense feel like maybe the public's acceptance could be strained if it's expanded too broadly. But then there are other people with conditions of emotional distress or what have you who feel that their need is equal to any other.
Let's just touch on what Stephen said, and also Andrew. So it is also true that in housing, the rules are different. So they are more loose, and it is confusing because an animal that may be permitted in a place that does not allow pets does allow emotional support animals, which is not a service animal. That animal would be allowed in housing, but has no public access under the ADA. That's another confusing thing. And as far as the airlines go, there's a new rule that the DOT has come up with, because not only, as you're right, there have been some sort of unusual circumstances, but it also puts at risk those of us trying to work service animals that are appropriately trained to behave in those situations. Some of the most dangerous situations I've found myself in with my guide dog or on planes with ill-trained emotional support animals. So there's a new rule that the DOT has come up with, and it is not mandatory. It is suggested, and many airlines are choosing to follow it, and it's much stricter, and it only permits actual service dogs. So anything that is not a dog, anything that's not legitimately trained as a service dog, as would be defined, as we would all understand through, say, the ADA, a form has to be filled out before you can fly. So that is a change that's happening. It will happen slowly, and it's being fought strenuously by the people with ESAs, emotional support animals. But it is confusing because there are really three different things. There's the ADA, there's the housing rules, and there's the FAA. And it's always been very confusing.
Well, thank you for telling me about this.
Situations, the likelihood of there being a problem. trained her.
Thank you for enlightening presentation. Absolutely. Our next item on the agenda is points to the good and welfare. Are there any points to the good and welfare? Any announcements? Anything you'd like to say?
That we should be aware of.
Yes?
Yeah, right. NFB is hosting the Bell Academy for the second time this year. We did it last year virtually. There will be 3 2-week classes, June, July, and August. Registration is open, and it will fill up if people want to register to get the appropriate, we have beginning class, intermediate class, advanced class. So if you want to get the right kit mailed to your student properly, you need to register and apply.
I was wondering if any students have registered yet. Do you know that?
I have not checked with National yet.
Because I want you to know, I have shared the information with the FESBE consultants and the town itinerant teachers several times. But if you find you need me to give a gentle nudge at any point between now and the summer, I'm more than happy to share it again.
Yes, thank you. And I understand we're doing a presentation next Thursday to let the parents know about this. I'm also running a Braille Readers program again this year for anyone, you know, wanting their children to, like, win a prize money contest for reading Braille.
Oh, yeah, that is great. And I did share that information with the teachers, too.
Yeah.
So that you get participation.
Yeah, that would be great.
What age range is the kids that get into this program?
Well, basically 4 to 12. We do make an exception if the 13-year-old would be a good mentor. You know, we may be able to bring them in, but the top number is 300. Because we can only accommodate so much with virtual.
Thank you, Beth. Any other points to the welfare? I would just like to add one point. With regard to Latin Americans Equality Day, last year's committee set the bar very, very high. And I wonder maybe if people are intimidated by that with regard to coming forward. And I just want to assure you that even if it's something as simple as a joint statement issued with other organizations that are participating in Disability Awareness Month and programs with regard to pedestrians, that would be okay too. The important thing is that our voice is heard. And since we are an advisory board to the state, people with blindness and low vision, you know, we're speaking for a large group, so whatever we can do to get the word out is okay. It doesn't have to be elaborate or sophisticated. It can be as simple as a joint statement. So with that, I hope that will inspire some people to come forward.
With 2 more points of interest.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, so the first one is, if you want to fly now, it's not a federal law, but you do have to go online, which is not accessible to us, and you do have to fill out a form for your dog, and Delta is different from American Airlines, and you will have to fill it out and put specific items for your dog to fly now. I assume that they will get on board with this and straighten it out to make it easier for us within the year. So I need to give them a little bit of time to work out the issues, because each airline is a little bit different. On the second note of COVID, it's very inaccessible to us. If any of you have been tested for COVID, you know that you can't go to my chart. It's inaccessible online. You can't fill it out. You can't go
You can't be, go to CVA, you can't go to Connecticut, you can't come back into Connecticut without filling out a form, because that's inaccessible to us. And if you don't do it, you're fined $1,000 if you don't take the COVID test. So these are issues that are ongoing for those of us that don't have accessible websites. So I'm grateful for the COVID phone number, because otherwise we wouldn't be able to get there.
Please remember, 211 is resource. So if you don't remember the number, or if you're not sure where to go, who to call, what website to visit, you can always call 211. With regard to the travel advisory, it is, I believe, effective Friday. It is only an advisory, and there are no more fines associated with non-compliance.
Yeah, if anybody wants to come on my radio show, I'm in my 29th year, and if anybody wants to come on, they have topics for people 55 and over, and our population is not only people who are blind, but anybody that needs access to the printed word. So you can call me, and we'll try to work out a program. So I go to the radio station once a month, and record between 2 and 4 shows. So thank you.
Thank you, Steve, and congratulations on 29 years. You are providing a valuable service. There's a lot of information and a lot of stuff that people wouldn't otherwise know about because of your radio program, so I thank you for that.
Thank you.
This is Catherine Goodman. Can I say something?
Sure, Catherine.
I just didn't know whether this was on anybody's radar or not, but there is right now, basically it says right here, I'll just read the thing my husband was telling me about this, that Connecticut is being sued by a disability rights group over discriminating against persons with disabilities and not prioritizing them over the general population.